Support for NPR podcasts comes from HBO, presenting The Wire. The final season premieres this Sunday at 9 p.m.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After twice surviving cancer, Susan Sontag, one of America's best-known public intellectuals, was diagnosed with a particularly lethal form of blood cancer, myelodysplastic syndrome. She underwent a bone marrow transplant, which is a risky treatment with painful side effects, hoping it would save her, but it didn't. She died in 2004 at the age of 71. My guest is her son, the journalist David Reif. He's written a memoir about Sontag's death and the unanswerable questions he was left with. It's called Swimming in a Sea of Death, A Son's Memoir. Reif is a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine and has reported from several war zones. He's also the author of seven previous books. Susan Sontag wrote much-discussed essays about photography, the sensibility of camp, illness, Eastern Europe, and the war in Bosnia. She also wrote a best-selling historical novel. David Reif, welcome back to Fresh Air. You had to ask yourself a lot of difficult questions while your mother was dying, and one of the questions you asked yourself was, should you be honest with her? You basically saw her diagnosis as a death sentence. She believed she really stood a chance with the bone marrow transplant. And so you had to figure out whether you were going to reflect the optimism that she had or the pessimism that you believed to reflect reality. You say that she always thought of herself as someone whose hunger for truth was absolute, but this was a situation where you weren't sure you wanted to be honest with her about what you really thought.
Well, it's worse than that in a way, Tara, because I think she demanded honesty, but she didn't actually want honesty in this case. She wanted to be, I mean, that's what I try to write about in a sense that it's at its starkest, that what my mother wanted from me, it seemed very clear, was some kind of optimistic spin or optimistic account of her chances, or at least not a pessimistic one. And I thought a lot about that, of course. I thought, well, what happens if I tell her the truth? What happens if I say, look, all the doctors are telling me it's possible that you'll survive, but the chances are starkly against you? What would that have accomplished? I kept wondering. Would it have allowed her to in some way come to terms with her death in a way that would have made her death easier? And I thought in the end, I'm getting such a strong signal from her, both in words but also in, by which I mean in terms of the questions she would ask. You know, I remember her saying to me, well, you know, I'm much younger than my biological age. Don't you think that's true? Well, in a sense, whatever the grammar of it, the reality, the human reality is if someone says that to you and then follows the assertion with the question, don't you think that's true? She's telling you, tell me it's true. And in the end, I thought, but it's her death. It's not my death. What is this truth? What am I doing telling her the truth? Is that for her or is it for me? Is that if I told her the truth, maybe I could force her to have a conversation with me that about our past together, about our very complicated, and they were very complicated, relations. I would have perhaps been able to have asked her questions that maybe I would have liked to have asked her. But that's all for me. For her, she wanted to live. She didn't want to feel it was time to have those conversations. And it seemed to me, again, it's her death, not mine.
Well, one of your mother, Susan Sontag's most famous books was Illness as Metaphor. And she wrote this after her first cancer, her breast cancer. And one of the things she wrote about in there was how she disliked how people used the metaphors of war when it came to dealing with cancer, you know, like battling cancer. I wonder, like, when she was sick, what language she used to describe her own feelings about what was happening to her body? Like, what kind of language did she find for it?
Well, I think she tried to find, on the one hand, the language of science, and on the other hand, the language of pain. A lot of what happened to her in the last months of her life were just being in agony. Basically, everything went reasonably smoothly until the transplant itself, the process in getting someone ready for a bone marrow transplant is basically to destroy their immune system with radiation and drugs. And that actually she weathered. People die during this. It's not and someone at her age, they were very worried about this because they hadn't done it to that many people of 70. But she did incredibly well, and they found a donor who was a match. But once she had the transplant, basically everything that could go wrong went wrong. Every kind of illness, every kind of physical affront. So, I mean, within a very short time, she was deep in just the language of pain, the language of the being flayed. But there was nothing military or, you know, it was really just sort of, I hurt, I can't swallow. Everything, you know, my mouth is a sore. When she died, I was there a lot, but of course you both look and you don't look. And after she died, I asked everybody, there were a bunch of people there, and I asked them to leave. And I took her shirt off, and it was just a sore. Her body was a sore, one big sore, and it was amazing. It was unbearable. And how she bore it, I don't know. But we were pretty far from the end of Ildis's metaphor, where she cites Lucretius and talks about giving the language of war back to the war makers.
Some people, as they face death, have religion, and they can believe in God or in an afterlife, in some meaning to life, in some, you know, redemption in death, and it kind of it surely seems to help ease them from one world to the next. And your mother was an atheist. Did she seem to wish she had anything toward the end, like religion or some larger philosophy or something? Like, do you know where I'm? What I mean?
I do.
Yeah.
I just think she really was an atheist, not an agnostic. I think if you're an agnostic, that's a possibility for you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're really an atheist, you just believe in the one life. You could believe that life had a purpose. You could believe you did good things. But you could believe your work was important. I think she certainly, look, by the end of her life, she was incapable of speaking in this way. Because she died horribly. I mean, she did literally, as I try to describe in the book, the last hours of her life, she was not in such pain or terror. She died in agony, and her death was an agony. So I don't think in the end, you know, a philosophical conversation. I know you don't mean it that way, but I don't think for an atheist that thought, if you really mean it, that thought is possible. You said even in the phrasing of what you said, going from one world to the next. But of course, if you're an atheist, you only think there's this world. There is no next. I mean, already to talk about the next world is a
no. You're right, and
I
noticed that as I was
idea.
Saying it. Yeah. No, absolutely.
You know, there's a famous story. I mean, this is a person who died, at least according to the accounts you read. I mean, these are just literary accounts, so who knows? But David Hume, who is an atheist, the Scottish philosopher, I mean, Boswell, the biographer of Dr. Johnson, came to see Hume on his deathbed. And in effect, he said, aren't you afraid of dying and aren't you tempted to accept Christ, you know, to ensure your immortal soul? And Hume very gently but absolutely implacably said, well, I don't believe there's a life after death or that the soul can be separated from the body. And I think that's unfortunately the atheist position. And to be fair to my mother, I mean, this may seem like an odd way to put it, but I don't mean it in any odd, and I certainly don't mean it in any ironic or let alone sarcastic way. But I think my mother took religion far too seriously, atheist though she was, to imagine that she could somehow accept it on her deathbed because it would make her feel better. I mean, if she couldn't accept it in her life, I don't think she could just sort of say, well, now that I'm dying, I need it, so I'll accept it. Or be so, I mean, maybe, I'm sure, look, people convert on their deathbeds. People accept religion on their deathbeds. But I don't think that was a possibility for her.
The impression I get from your book was that your mother was, like, afraid of death. I mean, she loved life and really wanted to live and would do anything to live, but that she was also afraid of death. And I guess I was wondering if you knew exactly what it was she was afraid of with death.
Like,
she wasn't afraid of hell. She wasn't afraid of afterlife.
No, again, we're back to, we're sort of back to our conversation where you were saying one world to this world to the next. My mother was afraid of extinction. I quote this amazing poem of Philip Larkin's called Obad in the book, which I think speaks for my mother. And I'm no good at remembering poetry, but basically it says, you know, what's all this being reconciled to death? Everything you are ceases to be and nothing replaces it. You are extinguished. And I think that's what she felt, and I think it terrified her.
I always found it interesting that she'd made several trips to Sarajevo during the war in Bosnia, putting her life at risk. And I know you did this too. You made trips there. For her, one of the things she did was stage a Beckett play. Mm-hmm. And I remember her writing about the kind of, you know, game of roulette that it was, that you were playing with your life just being there because death was so random. You know, a bullet would just come through the window and you're dead. Or you're crossing the street, sniper shoots you, you're dead. So here she was, somebody who like really feared death, putting herself in a situation where death was all around her, and death had this, death was like chance processes, you know, death was this like random act being committed all around you. And I guess it was always hard for me to completely make sense of that, but I'm curious from your impressions how that affected, if at all, her attitude about her own death.
You know, that's a very interesting question. I'd never thought of that. But I mean, I've thought of it for myself because I've been in a lot of wars and as a journalist, and I lived in Sarajevo, and I've been in, well, lots of other places, but including Iraq. But I don't know the answer to that. I think somewhere she knew she was taking this risk, and somehow she didn't connect the two. I can't really explain it. I don't feel that way. I mean, I do remember once in Sarajevo, and I don't know that I'm so much less afraid of dying than she was, as I write in the book. But I remember once a very bad time in Sarajevo. We were actually in a plane that was, as it was taking off, got hit by a couple of small arms rounds. And the plane was full of French soldiers. One of them got hit by the bullet, and he started to scream. And I was terrified. I mean, I've been frightened many times, but I was terrified in a kind of physical way. I thought, I'm never going to control myself. And then I remember thinking, sort of, it was almost like a kind of respite. I thought, it's okay to die today. And that was the only thing that made me calmer. But I don't think she ever felt that. I'm speculating now. But I have to feel she thought she'd get through it. That's all I can explain.
Do you think that at any point she crossed the line and realized she wasn't going to get through it and that all that was left for her was suffering? And I guess one of the things I'm really wondering here is, do you think it ever would have occurred to her to ask to have her death speeded up because all that was left for her was suffering?
No, it was the opposite. She, when the doctors in Seattle, she had the transplant in the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle, which is one of the great hospitals in the world. And when the doctors came to tell her it hadn't worked, she started to scream. And the only thing that consoled her was going back to New York. And then and having her doctor in New York, principal doctor at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, say, I'm going to try one last thing. So there was never a point when she was reconciled. The very last 2 weeks of her life, she said, not to me, but to a couple of other people, I'm dying. But without any calm or any sense of being reconciled, quite the opposite.
My guest is the journalist David Reif, and he's written several books, but his new book is a memoir about the death of his mother, Susan Sontag, and it's called Swimming in a Sea of Death. Your mother had cancer three times. She had breast cancer in 1975, and it was advanced, but she survived it through a radical mastectomy. She had a uterine form of cancer in 1998, survived that. And her final cancer 3 years ago, which was a blood cancer, is the one that did her in. A lot of people who survive cancer or any other form of severe illness say that they were transformed by it in some large or small way. The first time I interviewed your mother in 1989, and this was somewhat after she'd written Illness as Metaphor, which we'd been talking about, I asked her about how she thought, or if she thought she was changed by that first cancer. And if you don't mind, I thought I'd play you a little bit of what she said.
Sure.
So here it is. This is Susan Sontag recorded in 1989.
I think it was actually a positive experience. It may sound strange to say it. There are a lot of things I didn't like about it, like scaring people who love me, particularly my son, who went into a sort of deep despair when he thought that I was going to die. And that was certainly a wound in his life. And I didn't like, you know, being cut up and mutilated in operations. And I didn't like a lot of other things. And yet, I think it was a positive experience. I think it was a deepening experience. It's put me more in contact with myself I don't think it didn't make me into a different person, but it released things that were inhibited, I have more access to my own gift for intimacy, if I can put it in such an indirect and shy form. I find it easier and more necessary to express feeling for other people.
So Susan Sontag recorded on Fresh Air in 1989, and her son David Reif is my guest, and he's written a new book about his mother's death. I'm wondering if you share her perception that after her first cancer that she became more comfortable with intimacy.
I think whether it was true or not, I think she, before that cancer, had operated under the at least the idea, again, maybe it was only partly true, but it wasn't, it was at least partly true, that as long as she had the work, the rest was secondary. And I don't think she felt that afterwards. I what she said to you with that, in 1989, was what she thought. I don't know whether... I guess I don't know how much she changed. She changed some. I don't know how much any of us can really change.
After she died, you read her diaries. And I'm wondering if you had any reservations about reading them, whether you felt like you were violating her privacy when you read them, or if you wondered if she would have approved of you reading them.
Oh, sure. I thought that very strongly. In fact, I wouldn't have read them had I not had she not sold her papers, including the diaries, to UCLA in her lifetime when she was well.
Uh-huh.
The reason I read them at all, and it's a bit more than reading them, I'm now editing them. I have edited and turned into her publishers the first volume of the diaries that basically go from adolescence through the early 60s in New York, cover the period of her marriage to my father and many other very important things in her life, including, well, a lot of things. But I've edited them. I'm now wrestling as we speak today with an introduction, and I'll edit two more volumes. But I would not have done any of that had I not known that these materials would be public at some point, at which point I felt I've got better me. I have read them with great difficulty and great regret.
Why difficulty and regret?
It's hard. You know, they're very intimate. As people will see when they read these journals, the diaries are very tough stuff. It's not like the diaries of someone who writes about, I don't know, their literary life with a few personal asides. These diaries are intensely personal. But as I say, she made the decision. She crossed the Rubicon by selling these papers and not burning these diaries, which, after all, she could have done.
So are you finding out things about how she felt about you, her son, in reading these? Is that?
Oh, sure, there's that inter alia, although I wouldn't have said that's the main thing, mm-hmm, but sure. Mm-hmm. And I've tried to be very I've tried to play it straight. That is, I've tried to not just to put the things that I admire or that I like, but the things that cause me pain in there too.
So you've been editing your mother's diaries. You write in your memoir about her death that as she was dying, you consciously decided not to take notes on it. And writing is the thing in your family. I mean, your father, Philip Reeve, was a writer. Your mother, Susan Sontag, was a writer. You are a writer. Writing is, that's what your family does. You have thoughts and put them on paper.
It's the family olive oil business, yeah.
Yeah, right. But you decided not to take notes as she was dying. Why did you, I mean, since you ended
because
up
I
writing
want,
a book, why didn't you take
because writing is a form of self-armoring.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, writing is a way that you keep yourself from, you mitigate the experience. You take the experience and you turn it into writing. Any writing in the end, no matter how honest you try to be, no matter how self-lacerating you're willing to be, no matter how unadorned you're willing to be, it's still a work of prose. It's still an artifact. It's still a piece of work. And as such, you don't have to stare directly at what's happening. It's actually a way of distracting yourself. And I had the example of a couple of writers I know who had taken copious notes as parents were dying. And I felt they were trying to protect themselves by doing so.
What do you mean by protect themselves? I mean by
well, protect themselves from the full force of what was going on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I wanted, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, maybe I would have taken these notes and I would have written a better book, or maybe I would have taken these notes and somehow found out things that are now lost to me forever. But I felt it was a kind of cowardice. For me, I'm not judging people who do it. You know, it's none of my business.
One of the things I knew I'd want to ask you about, but you answer this for me in the book was how you felt about the photos that Annie Leibovitz took of your mother, Susan Sontag, as she was dying and even after she was dead. And these photographs were published in a book. And Annie Leibovitz is a very celebrated photographer who takes a lot of pictures for Vanity Fair. And your mother and Annie Leibovitz were lovers. I think it was a kind of on-again, off-again kind of thing.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So here's what you write about those photos, those post-death photos in your book. You write that your mother was humiliated posthumously by being, quote, memorialized, unquote, that way in those carnival images of celebrity death.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably all I have to say. I mean, I'm told, I have no contact with Annie Leibovitz since my mother's funeral. Annie only got to take those pictures because I permitted it. When my mother was in the funeral home, I mean, I'll go this far. I don't want to go much further than this. But as the next of kin, it was my choice to let Annie take the pictures. They were not authorized at the funeral home in New York to let anyone in without my permission. And Annie wanted to take these pictures. And I thought, Annie Leibovitz is a photographer. People respond to great events in their life. Artists respond with their art. So if this would help her, even though we were already on quite difficult terms, I thought, okay, it just never occurred to me that she would publish them.
Because when your mother was well enough to talk about her death, she wasn't ready to say that she was dying. You never really had a chance to talk with her about death or funeral plans. She didn't make funeral plans because she didn't expect to die back at the time when she was well enough to make plans like that. So you were left with the decision of where to bury her, and you decided to bury her in Paris, a city that she sometimes lived in and that she really loved. And she's buried, is it Montparnasse?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In the cemetery there, near the grave of Simone de Beauvoir, Jean-Paul Sartre is buried there too. Taking her body to, flying with her body to Paris, you had to think a lot about why there and what is a grave for. I know your mother didn't want, the thing you did know is that your mother did not want to be cremated. But what do you think now a grave is for? Do you know what I mean? Like the grave,
yeah,
isn't,
I tried
the grave
to write
isn't
a,
in your
yes.
backyard. It's not close to you in Manhattan. It's, you know, it's...
No, although I go back and forth to Europe a lot. But I don't stay very long as I write it. I mean, the last part of my book is about precisely that burial and the after effects. It's a kind of little epilogue that I tacked on to the book where I try to describe it. But I think graves are for the living, if they're for anything at all. And I thought three things. The first is I thought that the graves in New York City, the cemeteries in New York City are very ugly, unlike the cemeteries in other major American cities like Mount Auburn and Boston being the most obvious, beautiful place. And I thought to bury my mother in some awful cemetery in Queens was just not on. And again, maybe I was thinking of the living. I don't know what, really. And she lived in a number of places. She grew up in the Southwest and in Southern California. But she had no great fondness for Tucson or for L.A. And where she loved Paris. So I thought, and many of her friends are people who go through Paris at least every year or two. Maybe many of her friends much more often. So if they wanted to go to the gravesite, it would be there. As far as why that gravesite, well, I mean, it's the place where writers get buried. One of the two places where writers get buried in Paris. And I think I was just being very conventional about it. It's not that I think, you know, this is not a Ben Affleck movie. You know, it's not like I think when we're all away, Simone de Beauvoir and Samuel Beckett and my mother have conversations. I don't I don't believe in, you know, I try to write in the book that, you know, I don't believe they're there. And when I go, I don't stay very long. I sort of clean up the grave and sweep the, it's, she's buried under a tree and the tree sheds. And I, even though the gardeners in the Montparnasse Cemetery do a very good job, I sort of sweep up and then I go because she's not there.
I would like you to end by reading a poem that you quote in your memoir. It's by Abba Kovner, an Israeli writer.
Abba Kovner was a great Israeli poet who died of terribly in Sloan Kettering in New York in 87, cancer. Anyway, the part of the poem that I quote reads, soon we shall know if we've learned to accept that the stars do not go out when we die.
Well, David Reif, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
I'm glad of the chance. Thank you.
David Reif's new memoir, Swimming in a Sea of Death, is about the death of his mother, Susan Sontag. Mark Bittman is a cookbook author, newspaper columnist, and TV host, all of which came out of his interest in cooking as an amateur enthusiast. For 10 years, he's written a weekly New York Times column called The Minimalist, offering quick and often easy recipes for all manner of appetizers, entrees, desserts, and even smoothies. He's hosted his own public TV series, a companion to his best-selling cookbook, How to Cook Everything. That book won the James Beard and Julia Child IACP Cookbook Awards. Bittman's latest book is a spin-off of sorts. It's called How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. Fresh Air TV critic David Bianculli, who's pretty good in the kitchen, too, talked to Mark Bittman.
Mark Bittman, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's great to be here, Dave.
I figure that every cook has one or two tricks that he or she prizes above all others, you know, little golden secrets that just work brilliantly. What are yours?
I don't know that I have tricks. I think the tricks that I have are not secrets at all. I think they're things that just come from really a life of cooking and become sort of second nature. For example, there's a very, very funny old cookbook writer, French guy named Edouard de Pomayen, whose last name I'm probably mispronouncing, but he wrote a hilarious book called French Cooking in 10 Minutes, which is actually pretty instructive. But his first rule was, go in the kitchen and set a pot of water to boil. I don't know what you're going to use it for, but you're going to use it for something. And that's not a bad rule. And I think that preheating pans, which I generally don't say in my recipe instructions because I'm afraid that people are going to forget them or burn the house down or whatever, but I generally throw a pan on the fire a couple minutes before I start cooking so that it's hot once I start cooking. It just sort of makes things move along a little more quickly. Sufficient amounts of fat when you're cooking in fat, I think, you know, you have to use enough and you kind of eyeball that and see what enough is. I don't know that there's anything I do that's that slick.
Listen, your new book, How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, has an obvious limitation, no meat. But was that restriction freeing as well?
Interesting question, because when you started asking it, I thought immediately of this Japanese woman I met a couple of years ago who was a brilliant chef who only did super vegan, you know, really, really limited stuff. And I asked her why, because she ate meat and she obviously enjoyed it, but she only cooked very, very limited. And she said, it's like pen and ink. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, you know, you limit things so that you can explore the universe of them more thoroughly, which seemed like a very Japanese thing to say.
Sounds great, though.
But you know what? I think that I'm not interested in proselytizing for people to be vegetarians, but I am interested in proselytizing for people to eat fewer animal products. We raise animals now in what can only be called an industrial fashion. And I think the more people know about that, the more turned off they're going to be by that.
Well, one thing about the vegetarian cookbook that I was really surprised by was your sort of your admonition that you really had to sort of think of this in a slightly new way, like leftovers in your refrigerator could be the basis for new meals. I'd never really thought of a multi-day, multi-meal plan that with different grains and vegetables really seems to, you know, work out right for vegetarianism. Did you know that beforehand?
I didn't, although, you know, when you think about it, cooked foods don't go bad very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've cooked something, it'll stay in the refrigerator for quite a while. Now, it'll decline in flavor, perhaps, and freshness, but it's not going to decline that quickly, and it's not going to decline in quality or become dangerous, that is, rot, for a while. That's why refrigerators are so terrific. So it's just as easy to cook a pound of dried beans as a half a pound, and it's just as easy to cook 2 cups of rice or barley or whatever as 1 cup. And when you start thinking that way, it's just as easy to wash a head of lettuce as half a head of lettuce. All of these things will then stay, once they're cooked or prepared in the refrigerator, for days. And once you start thinking that way, you have the makings of different meals at your fingertips. Now, it can be argued that vegetarian food is less filling than non-vegetarian food, and that's probably true because hunks of meat have a lot of fat in them, and protein is high quantities of protein tend to fill you up also. So if you're eating rice and beans and vegetables and salads and soups that don't contain, you know, sausage and steak and chicken and so on, you probably will eat more quantity. I mean, you know, vegetables are more water-based than animals, so you're eating more volume. So you need more things to feel satisfied.
Can you point to a recipe in your book that surprised you, a vegetable that you didn't think was going to work out as good as it did or wasn't going to taste as good as it did, and you just ended up loving the recipe when you were through with it?
I will say that what really freaked me out when I was working on this book was how many different things I or we were able to do with whole grains. And we came up with a method for cooking whole grains that's faster and easier than anything I've ever seen. And we came up with a bunch of kind of casseroles and sauce dishes with whole grains that I was really, really excited about. So it's more of a category than an individual dish, but that's the case.
I'm really interested in your minimalist column in the New York Times. I'm wondering, how do you think it's evolved over the years, and what's your sense of your own readership?
The column is 10 years old. We had a little party for it back in September when I estimated that I had written the 500th column. I was freelancing for the Times starting in 1990, and in around 1994, my editor said, "We're relaunching the section, and we need a new column, and we're wondering if you'd like to do it." And I said, "No, duh, of course." And what happened that took two or three years to settle into was this kind of recipe that's not exactly a straight recipe, but that has some kind of, almost like a pop song, it has some kind of hook to it. There's something a little bit offbeat about it that makes it not traditional. I'm not just showing you, I don't know, how to make a vinaigrette, because I've written books that show you how to make a vinaigrette. I'm suggesting you make a vinaigrette with a tablespoon of soy sauce in it. I mean, it's almost that simple. I'm not just saying, here's how you roast a chicken. I'm saying, I figured out a way to roast a chicken that I think is really cool and slightly innovative, and I think people are going to get excited about it. So over the years, we've sort of applied the minimalist bug to almost everything that I've done, and I've written a lot in that section.
So who reads you?
I'll tell you one thing. A lot of men, and I'm not saying women don't, but what's changed in the last 10 years is that I get stopped now by equal amounts of men and women, and men are much more aggressive emailers, I think. They're not necessarily more frequent emailers, but they'll email me and challenge things or suggest new ideas, or they don't. Women tend to more email and say, "I really like what you're doing." Men say either, "I think you're an idiot," or, "I like what you're doing, but you could do it better," or, "I like what you're doing, and here's another idea for you."
Let's get back to our interview with Mark Bittman. He writes the food column The Minimalist for The New York Times. His latest book is called How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. He spoke with our TV critic, David Bianculli, who loves to cook.
All right, here's my big question in theory. What I wanted to do for the interview was pick out a recipe of yours that I was very skeptical about in advance. That
I am already amazed that you found one you could be skeptical about, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, I did. But I couldn't find it in the vegetarian cookbook. I had to go on The Minimalist and go back. And it was, we're in firm agreement as meat eaters that, you know, we're talking about ribeyes is the best part of the steak.
No question.
That, you know, simplicity is wonderful here. And you have a recipe which says instead of just doing it the normal way, just put it uncovered, you know, over a little wire thing in the refrigerator for like 2 or 3 or 4 days and flip it once a day and don't cover it. And then this gives it this crust that you can then cook with.
So it dries it out a little bit.
A little bit. Well, let me tell you, I did an A-B test. I got 2 ribeyes. I have a real good
butcher. I'm very glad you did this. I can't wait to hear what you say.
Yeah. So what happened was, so I kept one wrapped up and did it the way I normally would do. I did the other one. I did a rub on the equal rub on both. But the one that was dried in the refrigerator, after a couple of days, it started looking like ribeye jerky, you know. And the last time meat looked like that in my refrigerator, honestly, I threw it away. But I thought,
right,
okay, I can sue you if it doesn't work. I can talk to you about this or get some sort of – anyway, cooked them.
You didn't throw it out, though.
I did not throw it out. I cooked it. And eating them side by side, it was remarkably better.
Well, how is this a scary question? You got me all nervous,
yeah,
but now
you're telling me
that
– Because it looked horrible. It looks horrible. And
yeah,
you didn't warn – you didn't warn me in the recipe that it was going to look, you know, inedible before you cooked it. But it was so much crustier and crispier and better. So how did you figure that out?
You know, refrigerator is a pretty drying environment. And that's why people hang meat in cool places, because you want to – if you think about all the different meat preparations, the traditional ones of aging and drying meat, they're things that people love. And a prosciutto, which is essentially a dried ham, it's hung for 18 months and almost all the moisture is leaving that. And if you think of dry-aged beef, that's exactly what it is, dry-aged beef. But my thinking in the refrigerator thing was not really to age the meat, although that's something I want to try to play with at some point, or I've been threatening to play with at some point. My thinking was really when you are trying to brown a steak, especially in a home environment where you often don't have the kind of high heat they have in restaurants, your biggest enemy is moisture. And if you put a piece of meat on a rack in a refrigerator, I figured it would dry out, and the whole thing's not going to dry out. What's going to dry out is the outside, and then it's going to take a crust really, really well.
Mark, let me ask you, what was the first cookbook you fell in love with and why?
There were a few, but I'd have to say that it was Paula Peck's Art of Good Cooking. Paula Peck was this woman in New York who was friends with what passed for foodies in those days, but really was kind of out of the loop, and was, from all accounts, I never met her, from all accounts, a kind of unhappy housewife who decided she was going to take cooking a little more seriously. She experimented quite a bit. She had a very good voice. She wrote very, very clear recipes. And when something in the culinary canon was nonsense, she said so. Hers was the first book that I kind of cooked through cover to cover, and she did such things, such radical things as announcing that boneless chicken breasts were a terrific substitute for veal scallopini. Well, guess what? In those days, people didn't – that wasn't the – now you think of veal scallopini as a substitute for chicken breasts. But in those days, that wasn't what happened, and she further announced – that they cooked through in 6 minutes. And when you told people you could cook chicken in 6 minutes, you were telling them something that nobody knew. And that was really remarkable. So those books, you can still find Paula's books, Remainder, and used bookshops, because she also has The Art of Fine Baking, in which you will find the single best croissant recipe ever printed, I believe. So if you want to know how to make croissants, it's worth getting that book.
Okay. Thanks very much for being here on Fresh Air.
It's been wonderful. Thank you, David.
Mark Bittman's new book is called How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. He spoke to Fresh Air's TV critic David Bianculli. David is also the TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org.